Jenny Armstrong won 470 Olympic gold for Australia at Sydney 2000, competing alongside Belinda Stowell. These days, Jenny works in a number of important coaching capacities for Yachting New Zealand, as well as helping her own kids with their sailing goals. So my name is Andy Rice. I'm your host from Road to Gold. And let's welcome Jenny. Hi, Jenny. How are you doing?
Hi, Andy. I'm going really well.
And tell us, where are you in the world today and why?
So right now I'm sitting in the Netherlands, and I've just joined up with a bunch of our New Zealand youth team sailors who are just in here for their final get rid of jet lag and get ready for the Youth Worlds.
Excellent. Well, I want to ask you what your best tips are for firstly, let's say enjoying the Youth Worlds, but and also we can talk about performing, hitting your personal best, your personal goals. But we'll come to that a little bit later on, because there's three different strands that I want to ask you about tonight, Jenny. The first is I want to go back over some history about how you built up towards winning Australia's first ever Olympic gold medal in the women's 470, sailing with Belinda Stowell. So I'm sure everyone's going to want to hear about how that happened. Then I'm going to ask you about youth and junior sailing. And then I'm going to ask you about women's sailing. So those are our topics. But as ever, if you have bought the Road to Gold course and there's anything in any of the 12 chapters that you want to ask about, then we are also here to answer those questions. And we are in the thick of the sailing season in the Northern Hemisphere. So if you've been doing competitions recently, there's been a lot of international championships going on. And if you want to share any of your experiences there and tell us what went right and also what went wrong and maybe what you could have done better next time, maybe Jenny is the person that can give you some advice on how to polish the dirtier sides of your vase, which is a phrase you'll be familiar with if you've been through the Road to Gold course. Jenny, let's kick off with the history. So Australian sailing at Olympic level was in a bit of a state in the mid-1990s, I think it's fair for me to say. And maybe it was partly because of that, because of poor showings at Olympic Games in the 80s and the 90s, that Viktor Kovalenko came to be brought in. Now, I don't know what other things came in at the same time, but tell us about that period in the mid-90s, Jenny, where Australian sailing was at, particularly in the 470, and what needed to change.
Well, I guess, Andy, to be honest, I wasn't actually an Australian at that stage, so I don't really have a clue, except I knew that they were struggling to get to the Olympics. I was actually sailed for New Zealand in the 92 games, and I changed nationalities in 97 to be eligible to sail in 2000 for Australia. So pre-97, I know as much as you do.
Okay, so New Zealand had dominated 470 sailing in the 80s, and Hamish Wilcox sailing with David Barnes was, they were probably the biggest names of many successful 470 teams in the 80s. So when you're an aspiring 470 Olympian, it begs the question, why would you have jumped from New Zealand across to Australia?
That's a very good question, because doing that jump's probably the worst jump you can do in the world, jumping to Australia. But I guess it, I'd been to the 92 games and finished fourth. So I knew I had the ability to win a medal. But I just needed a few other things to be around me for that to happen. And I met my crew, Belinda, on a Volvo 60. We were both on a team. And she had all the components of a good crew that I was looking for. She was, you know, fit, strong, experienced. She was a 420 world champion. And she had the same motivation and goals as me. So it was actually, Belinda was the reason I changed nationalities for starters. But also, I guess the other components I knew I needed was good coaching. So Viktor was part of that. A good squad. They were starting to pump a lot of money because it was a home game. And also a squad. We had 10 boats out in the beginning stages of our learning. So we had a lot of boats. So it was the perfect scenario if I was ever going to be able to try and win a gold medal.
Okay. So when did you team up with Belinda, and how did your early results go?
So I teamed up in 97. Early results, not very good. At a mid-fleet. But I guess we were sort of I listened to Tom's podcast back, and we were kind of the journeyman. You know, we just put in lots and lots of time, and we just had the faith that was going to come right in the end. So we were sort of mid-fleeters until beginning of 2019, where we were starting to crack the top 10 at that stage.
Okay. One of the things that Hamish talks about on Road to Gold is he doesn't believe in releasing his sailors on the international scene until they're capable of top 10 performances, because he thinks that that can sort of dent your confidence and give you that sense that if you've been a mid-fleet sailor for a long time, that might be your place in life. So was that something you had to deal with, or could you go back to finishing fourth in the games in 92 and sort of leaning on that?
Well, I guess, to be fair, we did have our ups and downs overseas, being, you know, struggling with the competition. But I guess I forgot to mention there was one other component that I knew I had to have in place to have the chance to win a gold medal, and that was just going to be an unwavering confidence that I could do it. So I wasn't, with my husband and I and the group around, they never let me not believe for a second that we couldn't do it. Because I think going to Barcelona, where I finished fourth, that was the place that I was always going to finish, because I never believed I could win a medal. So whether that was me just never believing it, or my team around me, they believed I could do it, but they never made me believe it. So that was one thing that I knew had to be in place the whole time. So I guess I was quite driven with that unwavering confidence that we would get there in the end, and we did.
And so from what I'm getting from you about the finishing fourth in the games is that there must have been surely many factors, technical, physical, whatever else, but are you saying the primary factor why you didn't finish on the podium is maybe that core lack of belief?
That's it in a nutshell. I had the speed, I had the tactics, I just didn't believe it.
Right, and so you must have at some point had a sort of lifted the lid on your head and had a look inside and worked out what wasn't quite working. So tell us about that, because that sometimes requires some courage to admit that you weren't quite all there psychologically.
Yeah, I guess it just sort of, I mean, sailing was quite a different sport back in the early 90s, but it was just conversations after the games with my coaching team, and them sort of letting me know. They thought I understood that and I didn't know it. So it was a bit of, I guess, not good communication within my coaching team. So that was interesting. I mean, and in 96, I actually lost the trials in New Zealand. I was ranked number one in the world and then lost a home trial. So it was quite a journey to get to where I was. And but I think without having that fourth place, I would never have identified that. If I'd won a bronze medal, I never would have won a gold down the track, because we wouldn't have identified that as a problem.
Interesting. So what you think, at some level, if you'd have won the bronze medal, you'd have been satisfied and you wouldn't have delved as far as you needed to?
Exactly, yeah, because that would, for me, would have been way above expectation.
Right, okay. So you said that your husband and other people in your support team gave you that unwavering belief. So does that mean that they were constantly checking in on you and making sure that when you said that you believed you could win an Olympic gold medal, that you really did?
Yeah, so it was all, that was a major part of the plan. And part of that was also keeping Belinda on that pathway as well, because you need to be a strong team together. And so much so, like, I do remember one thing at the Sydney Games, is you had the AUS bib on, and then when you got to into the lead, you got the gold bib. And I remember this, that I actually threw that AUS bib in the rubbish once we got the gold one, because I said just, and I did it in front of Belinda, and it was like, we're not giving this one back. We're keeping this one. We don't need this other one anymore. So now looking back, I think that was that ingrained confidence that was, I was never allowed not to believe that it was going to happen, and we just had to follow the processes and the performance would come.
What was Belinda's reaction when you threw that in the bin?
A little bit shocked, but those sort of gestures were really effective with her, to seeing how much I believed in the team. So she was brought her along for the ride as well.
What did you recognise in each other when you first met on that Volvo 60 that made you believe that you were the team that could go forward together?
Well, I guess for starters, we were just best buddies. We were on this, two dinghy sailors thrown onto this keelboat, had not done any sailing. So we just reminisced about the dinghy days. And, you're in the middle of the night sailing along in the dark, so you just have these crazy conversations. But one of them turned into, let's going to go and win a gold at the games, which at that moment was pie in the sky stuff. But when the campaign fell apart, we actually went 470 sailing just for fun. And it sort of just happened. And then, a week later was like, well, shall we do it? And all right, what country shall we sail for? Was kind of, that was the biggest decision. What country, not should we do it?
I'm going to ask you in a moment how your training had developed and then how it changed when the Viktor Kovalenko question came into play. But we're going to go off Facebook now. So if you're watching us on Facebook, we're going to be carrying on for another 45 minutes or so, delving into some very deep dive subjects to help you sail faster, whatever you're doing. So join us on the Zoom link, which you should be able to find off the Facebook page. And we hope to see you on the other side if you are just watching us on Facebook Live. So bye to you on Facebook. See you back soon on Zoom. So Jenny, how were you going about things in a certain way, and how, if any, did those things change once Viktor came into the equation?
Well, it kind of, once Viktor showed up, was actually pretty much when we started our campaign. And so we just pretty much blindly followed Viktor, because why wouldn't you? We didn't know anything different, really. But the first thing he did say to us, which was probably also a big motivator, was that I was too big and Belinda was too short, so it was never going to work. So little does he know that that was actually motivated us to say, well, we're going to show him that we can make this work with two people the same height and not the perfect combination that he thinks it should be. So we proved him wrong in that way. And so that was also a little bit of a motivator as well.
Did he really believe that, or was he playing mind games with you when he said that?
Good question. I don't know. I'm not sure, actually. I haven't asked him that, but I think he had it in his mind how Ruslana and Ilona, their size, a small helm and a tall crew. So I think he thought that was the best combination. But I'm not sure that was the best combination for them. I think it's the combination of personalities and people is actually more important than the physical size, as long as you're in the ballpark.
I'm also thinking maybe the venue in Sydney meant that being optimized for straight line speed and having that tall skinny crew and the small helm, maybe is it less important for that venue than it might have been for others?
Yeah, well, I actually think that me being taller and stronger was actually one of our strengths, because when it was windy, I could do a lot. I could hike hard, having my single-handed background, and use the main sheet, which is the engine, once the breeze gets up. So I think that definitely was a big asset for us that I don't think other people saw.
Yeah. And of course, we've since seen, for me, the most stark example of how you can do things differently is Shimi Fantella and Igor from Croatia, who won the 470 men's gold in Rio 2016. And if you'd never met them before, you you would assume that Igor was the helm and Shimi was the crew. But yeah. they managed to win the Worlds and the Olympic Games in the same year, that effectively the wrong way round. So sort of further evidence that maybe these other elements that you talk about are more important, or at least as important as the pure mechanics of being the so-called correct size.
Exactly. And I think it just shows you that there's many different ways to make a boat go fast through the water, and it's not just physical stature or size.
So how difficult was it to convince Victor that you were serious contenders, bearing in mind he was already writing you off in physical terms quite early on?
I guess it was just a slow burn with him. We were the only ones that showed up for every practice, and we were just the hard workers in the fleet, because we were just very motivated and passionate that we wanted to get there in the end. So I guess we were the one. What I felt was that we were working the hardest from the group. And I guess that I said that before, that unwavering belief that it would come together. And I do remember the day it did come together was, it was a Wednesday afternoon. We usually work 9 to 1 and then we'd train in the afternoon. And then just one afternoon we were unbeatable. We were beating all the guys, all the girls in every race. And it just kind of clicked that day. And I think that was just a culmination of all the skills we'd been learning. And then it's come together. And then once that happened, your confidence grows and then it builds from there. So I guess we had that belief that that would happen one day, and it did.
People talk about athletes getting into the flow state. Is that something that you were experiencing that day, where things were just happening?
Yeah, totally. And I think the flow state is, it's even trickier when you've got two people who are trying to work together as well. So it's more complicated than a single-handed sailor.
Was it to the point of an out-of-body experience in any way, or were you sort of fully conscious of everything you were doing?
No, I think it's one of those days, and I'm sure a few people on the call have had them, where you just, it just happens, everything clicks. You can't exactly put a finger on why or how, but it just, everything works, and every decision's a good one, and every manoeuvre, every tack works. It was one of those days.
So what year was that particular Wednesday when that happened?
I think that would be 2018. However, we did that once then, which just showed...
98, just to check.
1998, yes, you're right. Sorry.
So a year into you teaming up together, you and Belinda teaming up together. So that's how long it took. That seems like a relatively short time for you to have found that that feeling together.
Yeah, but if you think about it, I came from 7 years Olympic campaigning, and Belinda was an experienced crew. So we were starting not from the bottom, we were starting a little bit higher up. It was more us learning each other and me learning to sail double-handers.
I want to come back to this, but I just want to see if Tim and his group, if we can get Tim Tyler and his group to open up the microphone. I just want to find out a little bit about who's in there in that room together. Hi, Tim.
Yeah, hi, Andy. How are you?
Very well, and thank you for rounding up so many people all onto to one call there. So tell us what's going on there, Tim.
Okay, well, I'm the waterfront director for the Kennebunk Beach Improvement Association, and these are some of my instructors and some of my students. Guys, say your name and just wave into the camera. Okay. Hey. Well, so we've got a really vibrant sailing program here, and a lot of these kids want to go for the Olympics. So I said, if you're going to go for the Olympics, you need to get with Andy's program and hear from the very best. So thank you for having us on your program.
Tim, thank you very much. And can any of you tell me why you sail? Do you sail for fun, or do you sail to try and win, or maybe both? But what's the most important thing? Can I get some answers out of you?
Go ahead, guys. Speak up.
I like to sail for fun.
You like to sail for fun. Was that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent.
Maisie, go ahead.
I like to sail for fun, but I also like to sail to win, because
I mean, it feels nice to win, so.
That's okay. Great. So winning always makes it more fun. Sorry, go on.
I like to suffer both winning and fun, because winning is just like a little more fun, I guess.
And sorry, what's your name?
Oliver.
Oliver, is it possible to have fun without winning?
Yeah.
So what other things about sailing do you love even when you're not winning?
I like just being on the water and like feeling the wind and stuff.
Excellent. Well, we are going to come on to some of the topics that might affect you. Tim, what kind of ages are you working with there?
Okay, well, we basically got, who's the youngest person here?
How old?
Okay, so we've got 8 to 12? 13. To 13. And, you know, with the last 2 years with COVID, we've really had to have some reduced sailing programs. So this is the first summer that we've really got a vibrant sailing program going on. And I've also got an instructor here, Raz, who's from New York, and I've got Nick, who's from Canada. So we've got a little bit of an international team here. But, you know, all my kids basically said, hey, why are some people great sailors and others mediocre? And I said, well, let's hear from the sailing legends themselves. So we're just thrilled to be on your program today.
Did I get your name right, Raz? One of the coaches, is that your name?
Yeah, hi.
Raz, what's your view about why some sailors are just average and others are great? What do you think makes the difference?
I think a lot of it is hard work and effort and also teamwork, how well you work with your crewmates and everyone around you to try to improve.
Great answer. Thank you very much. Tim, I hope we can get some more questions and more interaction out of your group. It's absolutely fantastic that you've rounded up your sailors to join us on the call today. And the most important thing on these calls is that you guys and everybody else on the call get what you personally want out of it. So please do use the chat box. And if we can get you in to ask questions directly a little bit further down the line, we will. Thanks for the time being. I'm going to just ask Jenny a little bit more about her Olympic sailing. So Jenny, Raz brought up the question of, he talks about hard work. Just give us your view on the relative importance of hard work and natural talent.
That's an interesting one, Andy. I think there's talent is obviously useful, but talent without the hard work, talent only gets you so far. You need still that hard work behind it. So sometimes you see some very, very talented sailors, but they they don't have to fight for it. So that's actually when they get to the pointy end, they don't know how to fight. So I think it can be a debt to your detriment at times. It's interesting because I think we see it in New Zealand here with a lot of the regional sailors who actually are quite isolated. So they have quite a different mindset because they have to fight for nothing's handed to them. They have to travel. They have to do a lot of training on their own. So they are also develop a kind of different mindset. So I think that's that common. You need a bit of a combination, I think, is the summary.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I think Pete Burling is an example that Hamish has used before. And I can think of a number of Olympic medalists from Great Britain who grew up in the middle of the country, far from the sea. And even Ella MacArthur, who grew up about as far from the sea as you could get, and ending up as an ocean racer and round the world record setter. So it's funny how the people that have the greatest challenge seem to end up with the greatest tenacity. It sort of seems obvious when you look at it, actually.
And I guess I'm also another example. I grew up in the bottom of the South Island of New Zealand. So I'm another example of that sort of being a bit more isolated and having to fight to get through.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And so you had that moment, that epiphany on that Wednesday afternoon in 1998. Let's we'll move on to our other sections of this call, but let's just take it all the way through to the Sydney Games. So just give us some other milestones, some other moments that set you on the path to glory.
Well, probably not many people know this, but we won the trials on countback. So it was a real fight. We had three regattas. The first one we did poorly. And so then it was a big fight back from there. So it was down to the last race of the last selection series. And I remember saying to Belinda, well, let's just go for it and see what happens. We finished second in that race. We're sailing in, not knowing if we'd won the trials or not. And we won on equal points, but on count back we won. So it was a real fight to actually get to the games. And then after we had been selected, we were better for that fight. And then we just had to fight with the rest of the world. So that was quite a journey through that part. The games itself was, it's hard to remember, but there's a couple races where I think they were pretty much close to a perfect race. So that's what I'm probably most proud of, those actual performances on the day, doing it under pressure. And I guess I didn't actually realise, it's interesting because you think it's all about winning a gold medal. When you don't have one, you think it's all about the medal. But it was actually the fondest memories I have is doing it with Tom and Mark and Victor, and just remembering those, that for that week, we put the performance down that we'd practiced for, that I had done Olympic campaigning for 11 years for, built up to, and on the day we did it. So that's probably what gives me the most pleasure from that now.
Yeah, so it's about the journey, not the destination. But when you've got the gold medal, maybe it makes you realise more that those moments of sacrifice, is it?
I don't like that word sacrifice, Andy. I think it's just a choice. You make different choices, and we chose to put all our time, effort, and money, to quote Victor, into this Olympic dream, and it worked out for us. I don't feel like we missed out on anything by doing that. We gained much more than we lost by making those choices.
If you choose the word sacrifice, does it mean your heart's not really in it as much as you need it to be?
Well, I think you're thinking about what you're losing, missing out on, not what you're gaining.
Yeah, which means that you have to enjoy the journey. It's surely impossible to enjoy all of the journey. So what were the bits that you struggled with the most, and how did you get your nose to the grindstone to make sure that you addressed the weaker sides or the less enjoyable sides of your campaign?
Tricky question. I think the key thing with us was just maintaining that focus, to remembering what we were doing it all for. I guess some of it, we had lots of struggles around money because I wasn't an Australian citizen, so we weren't eligible for funding for a very long time. So was kind of, that was, everything was a little bit of a struggle in that regard. We had the time and the effort, but we didn't have that money behind us all the time, so that made it hard. And you certainly had your ups and downs, but it was pretty smooth, and we had a good team around us, so yeah, it was pretty good. I've talked around it. I don't really know what I said there.
Well, there must, I'm going to come back to it. There must be some bits, some dirty sides of the vase that had gone unpolished, and that you at some point must have addressed and turned some of your 3 or 4 out of 10s into a 7 or an 8 out of 10. Can you think of any examples of your campaign?
I mean, we always had, I guess light wins was what always was, and probably still is to this day, one of our weak part of our sailing, because we just both, I was never very comfortable in light winds. So I guess in that regard, we had to try and force ourselves to like it, to embrace that challenge. So that was quite a challenging thing for me. And, you know, light wind sailing, as everyone here will know, is the more tense and uptight you are, the worse it goes. So that was a challenge in that regard. You know, Victor's also, on the other hand, not the easiest person to get along with, and initially his language was pretty shocking, so it was a wee bit hard with that that dynamic. And I think Tom alluded to it in his talk the other time. In fact, you had sort of the A team and the B team, and we were in the B team for a very long time. You were sort of fighting for attention and just little snapshots of things to improve on. So it was quite a it was a very East European coaching style, which was very coach dominated, which worked in that environment. Well, it worked for us in that environment, in that moment with the lead up to the games. I don't know. I mean, this is going on to what we're probably going to talk about later. I don't know if that works nowadays with a more athlete-centered approach. So that was hard at times, having that style. But I guess, like I said before, that unwavering belief that we were going to do it with or without Victor was kind of the thing I had going on in my head.
Well, the Eastern Bloc countries, in the era of the old Soviet Union and East Germany, were certainly very successful in many different sports across the Olympic Games, including in the sailing. So clearly there is something to those methods. So I guess we can't completely disregard them. What do you think was the most valuable aspect of what Victor brought?
I think Victor's, he's like a master for planning a campaign. With the time available, he was a master at putting the campaign blocks together and getting the bits in place to be able to win. And I think that's his strength to this day, his strength. And I do remember something he said to us way back in the beginning. And part of that was, which I actually kind of now I'm coaching, I understand it more, was I'm trying to improve you as people. I can teach you the sailing stuff, you know, that's easy, but I'm trying to improve you as a person, and then the sailor, that will make you a better sailor. And I didn't really get it at the time, but now I kind of, I understand that side more.
So that this goes beyond your sailing skills. Becoming a better person, what does that mean in Victor terms?
So being a good teammate, being you know, very balanced in your mood, not having big highs or big lows. One thing I do remember he said to us is at a moment when I think I was crying on his shoulder in the boat park, and he is, was to, he wanted me to walk around the boat park like I already had a couple of European championships and a world championships, just to walk around, walk up, you know, stand taller, shoulders back, and just have that air of confidence. It's kind of that fake it till you make it kind of thing. And I remember that really well, and that kind of goes along with my confidence kind of underlying theme that I had for myself. And I think that truly helped as well. So it was little bits that he just sort of popped in there at the right moment and to build you up as a person. So that when your sailing skills did develop and you got to that successful side, you were better able to handle the pressures of leading a regatta or a race or, you know, winning an Olympic gold medal.
Mm. Jenny, thank you very much for that. I really must take us on to some of the other things that we're going to talk about on this call. So let's talk specifically about youth sailing. And as we speak, we're just less than a week away from the start of the Youth World Championships, where it's going to be, 800 odd competitors across something like 10 different disciplines. And there's only one representative per country. So in many respects, this is like an under 19 version of an Olympic regatta, I suppose. But we're dealing with people who are much younger than most Olympic competitors. So what approach are you taking with your sailors? Firstly, tell us your capacity that you're working there, and then tell us about your approach.
So we have nearly a full team. We're just missing a girls' kite. And I'm in a team of three coaches and one support staff So I'm one of the coaches. So we're going to be switching around, trying to make sure. And I guess our goal is to walk away from this regatta with everyone having put their best performance down, whatever that looks like. For some, it'll be medals. For some, it'll be, you know, small goals along the way, or getting to the top mark in good shape. So it's trying to help every athlete on our team put their best performance down at the regatta.
Now, Tim's group earlier, I asked them what's more important to them, winning or having fun. And obviously winning is a great way of having fun. But what is the most important thing at this point of people's sailing career, assuming that what they're doing now is building up towards having a long and successful sailing career as a senior racer?
Well, I guess, there's two things. I mean, fun is a big part of what the New Zealand team's about. And part of the reason for that is because sailing is the best fun you can have. So we want to emphasise that. But we also want to make sure that these sailors do have a long and illustrious career. And the Youth Worlds is just part of their stepping stone to any further aspirations. So that's also an important part of it. But also we do specific pre-briefs before setting up goals for each individual team or athlete, so they have got particular things to work on. And then after the regatta, we'll debrief them on that. So we've got specific goals they're working on, and none of them are performance-based or results-based. It's just on their actual individual performance. But the key thing is for me, especially as being the women's sailing manager as well, is I've got a bunch of youth girls here who I want to continue onto the high performance sailing, Olympic sailing. So kind of nurturing that talent through as well.
Okay. And when you look at the sort of the voluntary, I can't think of the right way of saying this, but what I can see is that whenever you compare the number of male campaigns with equivalent number of female campaigns at Olympic level, which is quite easy to do by going through the world rankings, it's clear that it's harder to keep women involved at high level campaigning than it is to keep men involved at high level campaigning. So firstly, do you agree with that?
I think the numbers prove there's more men Olympic sailing than women, but I'm not sure if that's because it's hard or just because there's just less coming into the pipeline coming up. So part of my role is actually trying to support that pipeline. So from the Optimus girls through to the Starling P class and all those transition points through and then into the youth classes and then transitioning from youth into Olympic. So part of my role is just supporting that, educating and those particular transition points to guide people into stay in sailing for starters, but also to select the right class that will suit their physique, their motivation, the things they love about the sport, if they like sailing together or separate, or they like going fast or slow. Yeah,
and so if there's a particular class that you want to sail at junior or youth level, but you may not be the right size for it, but it's a boat that particularly attracts you for whatever reason, either for speed or tactics or because you get to sail with your best friend, what for you is the most important reason to choose a particular boat?
I think because it attracts you first and foremost, because you really like it. I think that's always got to be the first thing when you're picking a boat. Some of the boats, and I think it's part a lot is the characteristics of the boat. You know, if you like the grind, an Elka 6 would be a perfect boat for you. If you like going fast and you want to sail with someone, well, a 29 is probably good. So there's sort of a boat for every sort of characteristic and type of person. So I think first in that youth area, I think it's more about picking the boat that attracts you the most, because that's ultimately going to keep you in the game. When you're selecting an Olympic class boat, you probably need to be closer to that, you know, the range of body weight or size to compete at the top level. But at youth level, just pick the boat you love. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, excellent. I sometimes wonder, for the same reason as at Olympic level, whether there's a pressure from national federations to say, well, you're just too small for the Ilka, so you're going to have to helm a 420, or you're just too big for a 420, so you're going to have to get in an Ilka. I mean, should you go along with what the federation says, or should you just stick to your guns and keep on doing what you enjoy the most?
I'm not sure what that's certainly not the what we say. We want people to sail the boat they love, but you do need to, you know, if you do want success at that top level, you do need to pick the boat that fits your body, not make your body fit the boat. That's kind of the, and I think that works for junior and youth as well. You want to select the boat that fits you the best.
Now, you're working with two other coaches for the New Zealand Federation across, I think it's 10 disciplines, correct me if I'm wrong. What are the key messages that you were going to give to any of those sailors, regardless of whether they're a kite foiler or an Ilka or a 420 sailor? What are the common themes that they need to take with them into this championship?
I guess the themes we've been working on both in New Zealand, and I think these are attributes that you need to be a successful sailor, is that sort of resilience and the adaptability, all those kind of, you know, being, it's going to be important at the Youth Worlds here to be organised, because you have a 20-minute bike ride with all your sailing gear. If you forget something, that's going to be have knock-on effects to your performance. So we're trying to just focus on those, all those things behind the scenes that actually make your performance on the water, make you, put you in the best position to be able to perform at your best. So we've done a lot around that sort of time management and organisation, and then just being flexible and adaptable, because we know stuff's going to happen and things all go wrong, and we'll be, you know, something will happen, the lunch won't show up, or there'll be a delay, or all those things that happen in sailing. So we're just trying to create athletes that can best cope with change, and which is exactly the skills you need on the race course, because sailing is a game of that constant change and adaptability and coming back from mistakes and dealing with things. So that's, I guess, the key messaging across the team.
Yeah, okay, that makes a lot of sense. And you could get very different conditions at this venue, Scheveningen near The Hague in the Netherlands. It could be light winds, flat water. You were telling me just before the call, it could be also how much on the wave height?
Well, yeah, 3 meter swell was one of the forecasts I've seen already. It's a wee bit, quite a wee way out, but yeah, we could, hopefully we'll get a nice range of conditions which will suit those adaptable, resilient athletes.
It's also going to be the venue for the Olympic class worlds in a year's time. So I would have thought a good opportunity for some research and reconnaissance to feed back into the Olympic sailors, in your case, the ones representing New Zealand. So tell us about that process of information gathering.
Oh, you've caught me out. Yes, we're the forward party for the combined worlds next year. So we'll, between the three coaches that'll be on the water, we'll be trying to just gather some data and make some observations that we can feed back to our weather team to help support the next group coming through. So hopefully our Olympic sailors can gain from that. And who knows, we might have some of our youth team competing there as well. So
there is also tracking from SAP Sailing. If you watched the last Olympics, then it wasn't branded as SAP Sailing Analytics, but that was the engine running the tracking. And they track many other events, such as the recent Kiel Week. And Jenny, I don't know how much you would use that as a research tool, but I would imagine that for the Olympic sailors, watching how the youth racing plays out this year could be a useful research tool. Would that be right?
Yeah, well, you've got me now, and you know what I'll be doing in the evenings here, but also I've got my Ilka 6 girls. I've got them having a look at the trackers as well to see if they can, along with our weather observations on the ground, to gather some background information for next year.
Okay. In terms of relative attitude to risk, once you've got confidence about which side of a course to go, because you can see there's a gain feature, either more or less tide or closer to the shore means more or less wind, how much will you be encouraging your sailors on the team to really gun for that side? How much to hedge their bets by sailing closer to the middle of the course?
Well, that's kind of up to them, Andy. I don't tell my sailors where to sail, but I do talk about risk management over a regatta. So I guess the first 2 or 3 days, I always say the goal for the day is 2 keepers. So you want to try and do 2 keepers, 2 keepers, 2 keepers, and then you can see where you are, and then you can work out if you need to take a little bit extra risk to beat a particular person or to finish a little bit higher up. So for me, that would be the advice I'll give my teams, where they start and how much risk they want to take. Certainly current's a big factor here, so I will be reminding them of that. But you know, at the end of the day, they're the ones sailing the boat, they make the decisions, and they live and die by it. So it's we're there to support them, not tell them where to go.
Okay, so coaching in the, what you might say, the pure sense of coaching, you're not going down the instructional route here?
No. And I guess also what I was saying, we were trying to get these independent sailors who are adaptable. At the Youth Worlds, it's quite a different coaching style required because they're pretty much on their own. They might have some contact with us on a boat, but we don't know what that looks like. So we've created and been coaching them to be self-sufficient in that regard. And if they do get some input from the coaches on the water, we don't even have enough coaches to be on every course. So you might have a coach on your course one day and not the other. So they need to be really, running the whole show themselves. And then if we can add in, that's a bonus.
We've got 10 minutes to go. I'd love to hear any question or read any questions in the chat box. And maybe if you can just write in if you've done a recent championship or you've got a championship coming up, we would love to hear what it is that you're doing. And when you're thinking about doing that championship, what is the area where you would want to have a superpower? Maybe you don't have a superpower in that area at the moment, but where would you love to have a superpower? Just be interesting to know. So if you're brave enough to drop your thoughts into the chat box, then we'd love to see it. Jenny, talking about coaching girls and women working through from junior to youth through to senior, just tell us about your role at Yachting New Zealand, how long you've been doing that and where you want to take that.
So I started my role in October last year, so I'm only still fresh in the job. So I have two parts of my role. One is the Ilka 6 program lead. So I look after the Olympic girls and the youth girls and boys within that program. So that's supporting the youth training programs in there, and then the individual athletes within those programs. And then on the other half of my job is the women's sailing manager. So that's high performance. So looking after, we've got girls in Europe at the minute, Olympic girls. So I'm touching base with them. It's a lot of connections and keeping in touch with the girls on the circuit, helping girls transition into different classes. And I run a kind of a program with my pre-youth, my junior sailors, just trying to educate them about what class to sail and what options are out there, and and also just upskilling their general sailing. There's lots of research around that. If you keep girls together in groups, they'll actually stick at a sport longer. So we're really trying to create that community of girls and women sailing to try and keep everyone in the game longer and to fulfill their potential.
Thank you for that. Tim, I would like to ask you a question, Tim Tyler. Thank you for dropping that answer in the chat box. So all of your junior sailors will be sailing at Booth Bay Harbour Yacht Club in Maine on Wednesday night on one of the first regattas of the season. So, Tim, tell us about this competition and how long it goes on for and what you aim to get out of it and what the kids aim to get out of it.
Okay, well, thank you, Andy. We have a series of races up in Maine called the Merck Races, and different yacht clubs will host regattas on Wednesday night.
Excellent. So, we're
racing Opties and 420s. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, so how do people decide whether they end up in Optimists or 420s?
We can leave it up to the individual sailors. A club will produce.
It's gone.
We'll say, you know, we'd like some Opties or 420s, and featured about providing.
Tim, sorry, it's gone a little bit jagged on the Zoom reception. Thank you for that. It went a bit wobbly there. We've got another question from Tim. Hi, Tim. Long time no see. Good to see you on the call. Would you like to come in? Tim Hartzog, sorry.
It has been a while. I'm not able to figure out my camera at the moment. But I'm here quarantining with COVID, actually. But coming out of the woods at last. Jenny, I really appreciate your talk. My question was my background is in sports psychology and I am a competitive sailor and was a coach in a prior lifetime. And I guess my question was, how do you view New Zealand's approach to sports psychology? Do you see it as being any different to how other countries approach it, and what's it look like at each level of training?
I don't really know what other countries do, and I'm still learning what New Zealand does. But I guess we're quite conscious, and we're trying to do that down through the ranks as to upskill our coaches to try and create the a sailor with the attributes that we know is what you require to succeed at the high level. I guess we don't really have introduced sports psychologists into our youth team, but more as a presenting some ideas for them to integrate with them. And the top level sailors do have the opportunity to work with a sports psychologist on a specific weaknesses, I guess.
Tim, I know you. It's difficult for you to talk about specifics of the people that you work with, but how do you see sports psychology developing? How has it changed over the last 10 years? Where is it going in the next 10 years?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, that's part of what drove my question about what is it like in New Zealand? Because it does feel like here in the States, there's been a shift to one, it's more and more commonplace. And I think stigma is going further and further away. But two, when you think about the mental performance, mental health continuum, I feel like there has been a greater and greater emphasis for better and worse on mental health. To the point where I think sometimes mental performance is almost kind of forgotten in a sense. And my sense is that internationally that there's still a pretty clear distinction, and there's, I think, more often emphasis on mental performance. That's my sense, you know. Okay.
Tim, now that you say that, we have had a shift, and I probably didn't quite answer your question properly, but we have had a shift in New Zealand recently because of some problems in other sports, a bit more of it. I mean, we've always had an emphasis, but a more targeted emphasis on that athlete well-being side. So before it gets to be, I guess, prevention, and so yeah. A lot more connection with athletes. And I guess part of my role is taking care of the woman and on that side as well, and just checking in with them more often and a more regularly sort of scheduled basis. So we are, there has been a shift. We're a bit more targeted with that than we used to be.
And I, you know, part of what I read into that is that it's a proactive approach, and it's, you know, where you're dealing with the whole person. And I think I see that. I think people recognize in the US that maybe that's important, but at the same time, it seems like the reality is most of the time we're addressing problems once they're problems, you know. And you know, these days, I think coming out of a pandemic and everything else too, like, maybe there are more problems than there ever have been, you know, but yeah. But it feels like that's where we are.
Yeah. And I guess it comes back to that, you know, what do you need as a sailor to be able to, you know, we're still about high performance, but what does that sailor need to be, and what do they need around them in their world for them to be able to perform at that high level? So they need to, you know, feel good about themselves, have that support structure around them and all those things, or they won't be able to perform. So I guess it comes down to that base level. And yeah. It's a people first thing. And also I think sailors, you have a long career. So, you know, you're only going to have that if you're happy and healthy for starters and enjoying what you're doing. So I guess that's at the core of it all is, you know, we're doing this all for fun. It's supposed to be fun, the sailing stuff. And that's what I try and bring out in my coaching. And then also when I'm sailing, I do it just for the pure love of it. And I think we don't want to lose that side of it at any level of the sport. You've got to be doing it for that true love of the sport.
Absolutely. Yeah. Anything we can do to foster intrinsic motivation, you know, and something you said makes me think of that distinction I'm frequently making between mental health and mental performance, right? If I'm doing mental performance training, the goal, if I boil it down, is improving performance, and maybe as a byproduct, mental health improves, you know. And if we're doing mental health treatment, well, we're trying to address mental health, and maybe as a byproduct, performance improves.
Yeah.
But the two can very much go hand in hand, right? If we're having fun performing, then yeah, maybe we're less likely to experience whatever struggles.
Exactly. And prevention is always better than cure with everything, isn't it?
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Thank you.
Thanks very much for joining us, Tim. And I hope that being on this call will accelerate you out of the COVID that you're suffering from at the moment. Really, really good of you to get on the call, and wish you all the best for getting better as soon as possible. Just my own observation, Jenny, about mental performance, particularly from a New Zealand point of view, it seems that the All Blacks, the rugby team, they always had the skills. They've been seen as the best rugby team in the world for probably the last 40 years or more, but they started to develop a reputation as chokers. There were a number of times when they should have won the World Cup, but they didn't. And I think it was your ex-captain, Richie McCaw, who looks as tough as nails, dealt with this choking reputation head on. And they really delved into the mental performance side of their game and asked themselves some hard questions about why they were coming up short when they were physically so strong. And I wonder how much that's permeated through the rest of New Zealand society. If the roughest, toughest guys in New Zealand are prepared to look inside their minds, does that give license to everybody else to do the same?
For sure. I mean, the All Blacks are the they're the kings of New Zealand. They're the pinnacle of, you know, New Zealand culture and sport. I think if the All Blacks, I know there's a lot more sports people these days showing their vulnerable side and showing their weaknesses or their, and I think that is great for them, but also to show that it's okay to be, it's okay not to be okay, and it's okay to have those moments or to take time out to get yourself in a better headspace. And I think those sort of role models are very, you know, I actually do it in my own coaching. I show my vulnerable side to athletes, because how can I expect them to tell me their inner thoughts if I'm seen to be this strong, hard-nosed coach? So I think you've got to role model the attributes that you're trying to get out of your athletes to help them perform at their best and, you know, like Victor said, be better people.
Jenny, I think that's a great note to finish on. I want to thank everyone for joining the call, and a particular thank you to our two Tims from the USA with their input and their questions. So to Tim Herzog, wish you all the best. Wish you, Tim Tyler, and all the sailors that joined us on the call all the very best for this Wednesday night at the Boothbay Harbour Yacht Club. I know you can't all win, but I hope you all have fun. I'm going to be meeting Jenny actually face to face for the first time later on this week when we both go to the Youth Worlds. We will be back to you soon with another Q&A from a great sailor. But for the time being, that's it from Road to Gold for this week. Thanks again for joining us, and we will see you next week for the next call. See you then. Bye for now.